Welcome to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey newsrooms across the country. I'm Christy Strausser, Odyssey's managing editor of news. We're talking about wildfires, how insurance companies are trying to avoid paying for claims when they strike, the reaction from states, and we'll also check in with a reporter who lost everything in the wildfires in California last year. Let's kick things off with KCBS.
Nevada has passed a law that allows home insurers to not offer coverage for wildfire damage. Could California follow suit as our insurance crisis continues? To explore this question, we're joined live on the KCBS Ring Central Newsline by Megan Fanmuntz, climate reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, who covered this story. Megan, let's first take a look at what's happening in Nevada. If the home insurance companies aren't covering wildfires, what are homeowners to do? How are they protecting themselves?
Yeah, and thanks for having me on. It's a really interesting situation in Nevada, of course. In the Tahoe area, there's still high wildfire risk, just like there is on our side of the lake. And so Nevada has seen an uptick in some home insurers dropping people there due to their wildfire risk. But unlike us, Nevada actually doesn't have a FAIR plan. So these homeowners have been left in a situation where they either can't get coverage at all or the premiums are extremely expensive. This new law, consumer advocates and industry reps say, is supposed to give more flexibility for these home insurers where they can both offer policy without wildfire or offer a policy that just covers wildfire, which means that these homeowners might end up finding themselves in a situation where they're now paying for two policies for what used to be covered by one.
And is this something that as we see this crisis continuing in California, and insurers are looking to make a profit here, and people who are insured are looking to insure their homes, what's the possibility that California does follow suit here?
Yeah, you know, to some people, it seems like a natural end. When we had an insurance crisis back in the 90s after the Northridge earthquake down in Southern California, the solution back then was to take earthquake coverage out of home insurance policies in California. And the same thing has done for windstorms, wind damage from hurricanes in states like Texas, Louisiana, and Florida. But when I spoke to both industry representatives and consumer advocates, they say that there's never been a serious conversation in the state about taking wildfire coverage out here because of how central it is to Californians. On the flip side of that, though, there's a lot of people, especially out in the East Bay here in the Bay Area, who are basically already doing this. They're on the California FAIR plan, which only covers fire and wildfire. And then they're purchasing a second policy that'll cover them for burst pipes, liability payments, and everything else besides fire. So in some ways, they say that insurance companies don't need to stop covering wildfire. They are just letting people go onto the FAIR plan instead.
What is the state of play in California where they've been trying again to strike this balance and trying to get insurers to come back so that premiums come down? Are we making any progress on that front?
Over the past year, the California Department of Insurance has been pursuing these new reforms, and they've marketed as having that balance you're talking about, that it's likely going to mean that rates will go up for customers, especially those living in high wildfire risk areas, but that it'll lure companies in to begin writing more policies. Over the past couple of months in particular, we've seen some big insurance companies like Mercury General and Farmers Insurance Group promising that they are going to start writing new policies or more policies than they used to in exchange for rate hikes for customers across the state. And so there is signs of tentative progress that these are luring people back. But a big question for homeowners and also for consumer advocates is going to be exactly how high are premiums going to go? And are those prices going to reach a point where even if people can get insurance companies to write them a policy, they won't be able to afford it.
All right. We will see how it goes, particularly going into an election year. That is Megan Fanmuntz, the climate reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, who covered this story.
What is life really like when a natural disaster hits your area and takes your home? Natalie Tavidian, a reporter for Odyssey's KNX News, knows firsthand. She lost her childhood home in Altadena, California, last year when the Southern California wildfires tore through the city. This month, KNX debuted her podcast, Rising from the Ashes. Tavidian takes listeners through this surreal and heartbreaking loss and the still unfolding aftermath of the fires in this show. She joined On Deadline this week to talk about the project and her experience. I'm Lauren Berry, and this is our talk with Tavidian.
So this is my most personal storytelling that I have ever done because I didn't just report on what happened. I was personally impacted by it. And there was something I said the day after the fire when I found out my home burnt down, my family home, the home I grew up in. I said, I'm not just telling this story, I'm feeling it in every bone in my body. And I said that in a moment where I was literally processing what was happening in real time. Like I called off of work, and then as soon as I saw the charred remains of the house, I called my editor and I said, take me live now. Like, if you guys want to talk to me, this is the moment. So I think that's what this is all about, is that the reporter becoming the story is the strangest thing ever, but I found that that helped me connect with people on a much deeper level. It's changed me for life. And it's really not just about the fire itself. It's about loss. It's about navigating loss. So when I presented this to our bosses, I sat in a room and I was like, listen, we're approaching the 1 year anniversary of the fire. I've had this thought in my mind. I want to tell the story from my point of view, because until now it had been other outlets reaching out to me, asking me about it. So I kept telling the story, but I wanted to tell it from like beginning to end from my point of view, where I was when the fire started, where I was when I found out, who told me about it, that there's a whole episode about a friend, another reporter friend who had to tell me what happened, the nitty-gritty, the paperwork, the emotions, and then ultimately what the story is really about, which is my dad, who we lost a few years ago, and then now the home that he built. So it became this way for me to process the pain and to kind of put the pain in a container. And it's just been such a beautiful process for me. I cried in the entire first episode. And in that moment, I thought, oh my goodness, what did I do? What did I pitch? I don't think I can do this. And I had a friend texting me in real time. And it's so real. It's so raw. And I talk about that. I say that my friend just texted me and told me, remember, you're not just the reporter. You are a person feeling all of these emotions. And I'm feeling it with an entire region. And every time I meet someone, it's like, we're all part of this club we don't want to be in. And so that's exactly what kicked it all off. And then I ended up doing six episodes, and we're releasing it all. And it's just, like I said, my most personal storytelling, because I'm telling it from like the depths of my soul. I've never told a story like this. I've always had empathy for telling other people's stories, but I learned the hard way that there is a really big difference between, like I said, telling the story and like feeling it in every bone in your body.
Absolutely. And it really helped me. I'm a reporter too, and I'm always, reporting on these tragedies, but it can take some time to really understand the human impact of it. And I think that's what the show provides, is this could happen to anybody, and what really happens when this type of thing happens, what happens to you emotionally, what happens to you logistically while trying to rebuild. And a question that I had, it's been a year about since the fires were actively blazing, but you guys still haven't been able to rebuild your childhood home, and the area around is also mostly not rebuilt. So how does that, like having to go around in a place that still bears the scars of this tragedy, how does that impact the process of trying to move on or trying to, heal from something like this?
It's tough because it's this constant reminder of what happened. There is no, I mean, it's the strangest thing ever. This is my community. This is where I went to high school. This is, you hear me talking about the podcast where I'm talking about the night of the fires. Oh, that's my childhood pediatrician's office burning down. I just went to a vigil actually a couple nights ago to cover it as a reporter. And I get there and it was in Altadena, and everybody was like, whoa, you could see like the views from a distance. This is so strange. It's so eerie here. It's so dark here. And you could just feel this like collective pain of the entire community. And it doesn't, Like, I don't think the pain is ever going to go away, but there's this hope that everybody else is feeling of the rebuild, and people get excited when they hear you're going to rebuild, because you hear a lot of stories about people not rebuilding, people leaving the state, people still trying to figure things out. So there definitely is a lot of grief and a lot of pain around seeing just empty lots, charred lots. I have heard people say, like, the Army Corps of Engineers was incredible at coming in and cleaning it up so quickly, and that makes it a little bit less painful because it's an empty lot instead of like the skeletons. They're just a bunch of clean lots, but you don't see a lot of like hammers and houses going up just yet. And I capture that in one of the episodes from my point of view, and I'm sure everybody has some sort of a different struggle with that, whether it's the finances, the bureaucracy, the permitting, the every city has its own rules. So I capture that like chaos, but that chaos is like right there. You're driving there every single day. That reminder is there. So that grief, like, it doesn't look dramatic, right? Grief doesn't have to look dramatic. There is a lot of like exhaustion and trying to function. And that's such a great question because it's like it's right there, it's in front of your face, and you're seeing that every day.
It must be so hard. We were talking a little bit over the weekend, and I get emotional when like my favorite coffee shop closes and I have to go past it. So I couldn't imagine just how hard that is to deal with every day. And since you mentioned it, I also wanted to dive in a little bit, if you can, to some of those logistical and bureaucratic issues that you were talking about, the permitting, you were saying that your brother was having to deal with stuff like that. Could you explain that a little bit for us and tell us which episode to look at to learn more about it?
Yeah, that one, the episode with my brother is episode 5. And the reason it's with my brother is because we have such a good like sibling, like we're taking so much on for our mom, right? I'm taking on the emotional stuff and he's taking on the logistical stuff. It's like she's so lucky. She has like the feminine and the masculine, and we're there for her. And I'm so grateful that we're there for her and we're rebuilding for our family and to honor my dad. But I've covered disasters for years, and you hear people saying things like, everything is gone and I don't know where to begin. Like, as a reporter, how common is it hearing that? Like, you're interviewing people on the worst days of their lives, and you're like, so what now? What now is like the question we all ask as journalists. And I still don't know what now. And I didn't really get it until it happened to me. Like, I did not understand this devastation until I lived it. And I think a lot of people don't understand why the rebuild hasn't happened yet. So let me give you one example. So in the episode with my brother, and it's funny because after I recorded it, he's like, there is so much more. That was just the tip of the iceberg. But just one thing that he was focusing on was the city needs to approve us as a fire rebuild. Really simple. This is a fire rebuild. You lost your home, so you shouldn't have to pay $100,000 to get a permit, right? But there is no formula, and this is something that I've been thinking of for anywhere, because the entire country is one disaster away from something like this. Like, are there plans in action? And the city does not have a plan in action. They too were scrambling to figure out where to begin. So the fact that when they input all the information in the computer, it comes up as a new build and not a fire rebuild. Now, a new build means you just bought a lot and you're building a property, and that's going to cost you at least $80,000 to get a permit. That's a lot of money that can go toward rebuilding. So he had to discover loopholes or figure out formulas to get it as a fire build. And he was speaking with one person in charge of the rebuild, and then that person either quit or moved departments or something happened, and then he had to start all over again. So there's so much frustration in the nitty-gritty in that process. So right now he's still tracing the paper trail, right? He's emailing people every day, calling people every day. I swear they know his first name by heart, because he calls every single day, hey, who is in charge of this now? Who is in charge of that now? And I think he explained it so well in that episode, episode 5, and he captures that frustration so well. And I see that in the people I interview as well, where when I was at that vigil, like I said a couple nights ago, I interviewed this couple and they were in tears. They were like, Altadena is my life, my home. I've lived here for 30 plus years. I said, are you going to rebuild? And they go, we still don't know how much money we're getting from insurance. So they haven't even started on like step one, find an architect, do all the drawings, submit the permits, get the okay, and then break ground. From my point of view, I think those are the steps. And then find contractors and then do your homework about who charges what. There's so many steps to it. So we still haven't broken ground and there is so much frustration around it. There's just so many steps. Like I really think that that episode, episode 5, captures that, like the frustration and the chaos and the this is why.
And it becomes like what you're describing, a full-time job
Oh
almost
yeah. Oh
to
yeah. He had
tackle.
a full-time job. He runs a business and he texts me or calls me some days and he's like, I can't focus on my business right now. This has become my full-time job. And it is not just my family. It is so many people who have said this rebuild has become a full-time job. And it really breaks my heart for people who, I mean, this area, especially, I mean, the Palisades, Pasadena, Altadena, there are a lot of multi-generational homes here where people bought it like decades ago, some in the 50s, the 60s, even longer than that. And they're such beautiful, like craftsman homes that will never look the same. One person told me that the other night. And yeah, they don't have the plans for that. We don't have the plans for our home that was built in the 50s. My dad bought in the 80s.
Oh,
Yeah, so there is a lot of digging to do.
those are beautiful homes. I remember driving around there near Pasadena. Oh gosh, probably 20 years ago now, but they're very charming, like special little neighborhoods, and it's heartbreaking. And then to pivot a little bit on a similar vein, but on the more emotional side, you've brought up your dad a lot, and it just seems terrible to me that your dad put so much into this home, and it could feel like you're losing a part of him. You know, I'm kind of sentimental like that about physical objects and my loved ones. And how have you guys been banding together to work through that? And how are you finding ways to keep your dad's memory alive?
Somebody said to me, it's so crazy to call what's happening to you a story, but it is my dad's story. It really is. At its core, what losing this home is a story about my dad. He was, my parents are Armenian immigrants from Lebanon. This is the first big purchase they made in the 80s. They closed escrow on this home and brought me home from the hospital. I've taken my first steps here. I've had my sweet 16 here. I grew up here. I moved away for college, came back, moved away for something, came back. It's like it's that anchor. This is my home. So losing him about 4 years ago now and losing the home that he built was that's what makes this so much more difficult for me, that it's more than just losing these walls. So the whole rebuild is really in his honor. I think if he were around, the story might be different. We might, who knows what would have happened, but we might not be in this rebuild phase. We might not be as attached to that property as much because, that is, he chose that location. He looked at the mountains, which is so ironic now that those were the mountains that were burning and took our home away. But he just loved sitting in the backyard and staring at those mountains. And it brought him so much peace. He just loved the nature. And so rebuilding is not construction. It's really about honoring my dad. His name was Carlo. And one of the coolest things to happen were that a couple days after the fire, this ring, I used to only wear it for special occasions. It's a diamond ring, and my dad gave it to me for Christmas. I was like, why'd you give me a ring for Christmas? He's like, oh, it's just a right-hand ring. He was a jewelry designer, a gemologist, so he made it. And it's in the shape of an infinity, and I like to think of it as like his infinite love for us. So I had this in a drawer in my bedroom. I knew exactly where it was. So I never wore it, only wore it on special occasions. And now I don't take it off. It's like what you said about sentimental things, especially when somebody has passed. I mean, we his guitar burned, his harmonica burned, photos, clothes, t-shirts. I really wanted to make a quilt out of all his clothes for my mom one day. So all of that is gone, but this ring that he made for me, I found it in the rubble 3 days after the fire, and I hadn't smiled. I barely had eaten, and just that day, I went like laser focused. Something in my gut tells me I'm gonna find this, and I start digging. And my brother was on the property, and we borrowed some shovels from a neighbor, and then the fire department showed up. They saw us, and they were like, "Why are you digging with your bare hands? Let us help you." And they got with their gloves and they started digging for us. And after like a few silver pieces, they were like, "Is this what you're looking for?" And this is like that gave us a little glimmer of hope. And the funny thing is, it was charred. It was this platinum supposed to be white. It was black. My brother somehow brought it back to life. But the coolest thing was that there were three diamonds that were shining, and I was like, "Oh, that's me, my mom, and my brother. That's like my dad telling us that there is something beyond what happened, where he was showing us a sign that you're going to be okay, and that I found this ring." So the infinity ring plus just all these little signs that he sends us is like, this is a story about love. This is about my dad. This is about rebuilding in his honor. And I, spoiler alert, I end the podcast the very last episode with, I hope to one day invite you all to our housewarming party. So hopefully one day I can invite you to our housewarming party. But again, right now we are living in the unknown. We do not know what's next, but we have submitted everything for the permits and we're getting closer.
Oh my gosh. Well, I hope things go as smooth as they can. That is
Me
such a
too.
heartwarming story about the ring. Oh my God. And a beautiful ring. Good job,
Thank you.
Carlo.
Oh, thank you.
Lovely ring.
Yeah,
But yeah,
it's all about him.
I do feel it from what you're saying, it feels like he's a protective presence there at the house. So I'm glad you guys
Yeah.
have that.
Yeah, and honestly, I really, really hope that people listening can feel less alone when it comes to grief. So whether it's like for me, it's obviously it's the house as the anchor that I'm grieving, but whatever it is that you're grieving, it's I take you through these like the ups and the downs and the crying and there is laughing and there is a little bit of everything, and I really hope to that's what people walk away with, is that you're not alone.
Is there anything after having lived through this and now through all of the aftermath in the years since, do you have any advice for people or anything you want people to know in case something like this
Yeah.
happens in their region?
Oh, I mean, you hear it again and again to have a go bag, to be ready to go, to have a list of things that you would save. Like we saved photo albums, right? Like things that are easy to roll out, have boxes you can roll out. But something like this that happened so quickly and we had absolutely no time. Like I'm grateful that we do have a family business and we had all the important documents and passports and paperwork and all that stuff in a safe away from the house. But I think that it's so important to, yeah, to ask the hard questions. What would happen? Like whether it's a flood, a fire, a tornado, an earthquake, whatever natural disaster it is, the most important thing that we realize is dealing with insurance is having photos of everything, and we had photos of nothing, and have like a plan of your home. A lot of people don't have that, especially multi-generational homes that were drawn out many, many years ago. So that was one big struggle. So, I mean, I have a long list of things that are so important, but I think that's one of the most important things. Like, go take photos of every drawer, everything that you have in your house, because insurance is going to ask you for line by line of every single item that was in your home. Like, imagine sitting there and just trying to visualize every drawer, every like the bathroom, the kitchen, the china, the whatever you have. So that was really difficult. So, like, photos of everything in your house. Definitely a go bag for you, your pets, your kids, whatever that is. And yeah, asking if there is some sort of a disaster rebuild plan, and also make sure you are insured, because one of the craziest things that happened is my brother told me about a year or two ago, our insurance dropped us, and he just got, and you know, our dad has just passed. He took care of all that stuff, and we got a letter, and he was like, this looks serious. I should look into this. And he did look into it, and thank goodness. I mean, we were underinsured compared to what it was before, but at least we were insured, or else I don't know where we would be right now. So make sure you are insured. And even if your home is paid off, because lots of times when homes are paid off, people don't have to get insurance. So I hope that explains it in like the fewest words as possible. Like, make sure you're insured, take photos of everything, and have a go bag. Or for me, from my experience, is like the most important in a disaster.
Perfect. Great advice. When you were talking about those photo albums, I was like, oh my gosh, I just moved recently and the photo albums are the heaviest thing in the house and they're the hardest thing to get out. And I'm like, oh, in the middle of a fire trying to get photo albums out. You guys have been through it. I'm so happy that
So
you're
we
okay.
saved like 70% of our photos actually, and we did it all in under 10 minutes because my mom had somehow found boxes a couple days before. Like, people had tossed out these plastic boxes. So whatever fit in them, we took, and there's like surveillance footage of my brother and I with hard hats on because it was so windy, just pushing boxes and whatever fit in the car. We took that.
That's
But
amazing.
yeah, it's just such a lesson in how quickly something can happen. Like, we weren't, nobody was prepared for it, you know? So grateful to have rescued photo albums. Those are worth so much. Honestly, I really, really hope that people listening can feel less alone when it comes to grief. So whether it's like for me, it's obviously it's the house as the anchor that I'm grieving, but whatever it is that you're grieving, it's I take you through these like the ups and the downs and the crying, and there's laughing and there's a little bit of everything, and I really hope to that's what people walk away with, is that you're not alone.
You can listen to and subscribe to Rising from the Ashes on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
While people in many states worry about wildfires, others are concerned about wetlands. Specifically, in Louisiana, the Supreme Court heard arguments on Monday in a case that could be pivotal both for coastline communities and oil companies. As background, after local Louisiana communities sued Chevron for damage to their wetlands, a state jury ordered the oil company to pay $745 million for wetlands restoration. Chevron wants the case moved to federal court instead, which is typically a friendlier venue for oil companies. Here's more from Tommy Tucker.
Quickly to Dane Ciolino, professor of law at Loyola, about the Supreme Court and this coastal damage suit. If you can, please take us a second and give us the underpinnings of this so people understand what we're talking about.
There have been many dozen lawsuits filed by parishes across the state against oil companies alleging that those companies damaged Louisiana coastal areas and marshland by engaging in oil production activities. Cutting canals and those sorts of things that have caused the loss of wetlands. Those cases were brought in state court, and the oil companies have attempted to remove the cases out of state court and bring them to federal court because typically a federal venue is going to be more favorable to defendants in these sorts of cases than a state venue. The oil companies have not prevailed in their efforts to remove the cases to federal court because they have to establish that essentially the oil companies were working under the direction of a federal officer in matters relating to federal contracts. The argument that they have so far lost is that the government entered into a number of these contracts to get aviation fuel back in the World War II era and post-World War II era. But But the Fifth Circuit, the U.S. Appellate Court in New Orleans, found there wasn't enough nexus between the federal contracts and the damage caused by the oil companies. Now, yesterday, the issue was brought to the United States Supreme Court. It's kind of an odd issue. It's a highly technical federal jurisdiction and procedure question, not some interesting issue like abortion or redistricting that we typically see out of the Supreme Court. And the justices seemed pretty skeptical of the efforts by the oil companies to get these cases out of state court. I mean, it still remains to be seen what they'll do. But by all indications from the justices' questioning of the lawyers yesterday, these cases look like they're going to wind up staying in state court.
So to be clear, and correct me if I'm wrong, this what the Supreme Court heard has nothing to do with whether or not the oil companies are liable for coastal damages or refilling canals or this or that or the other thing. This is all about what court it should be heard in, or am I making that up?
That's exactly right. It's a highly technical issue under the federal officer removal statute.
So what does it mean for either side? From what you just said, I would guess that the plaintiffs want this to be heard in state court. And what about this Plaquemines deal with the case that's already been decided? What would that do with that verdict? Would that nullify that?
That was a $700+ million verdict that the parish got against these oil companies. The oil companies had attempted to remove it, but were thwarted in that effort. If the Supreme Court says that removal should have occurred and the federal courts did have jurisdiction, then that would imperil that $700 million verdict and also cause all of the remaining suits pending in state courts across the state to be transferred to federal court.
And I don't want to hurt myself here, but would it render it moot? Because it seems as though if the state court had no right to hear it, then how can you have a verdict?
Exactly. And then the matter would go back to square one in federal court.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey. On Deadline is written and produced by me, Christy Strasser, and by Lauren Barry. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.